Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Johnson of the Milwaukee law firm of Beck, Chait, Bamberger, and Polsky. I represent the appellant, plaintiff, Guaranty Bank, in this matter. This matter is on appeal from a final judgment from the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Judge Randa presiding, who issued a final judgment on August 29th of 2007. In that ruling, Judge Randa denied Guaranty Bank's motion for summary judgment and granted the appellee, a defendant, Great Northern's motion for summary judgment. This lawsuit concerned, which was initially filed in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, concerned a claim by Guaranty Bank seeking coverage under a comprehensive general liability policy for claims made against Guaranty Bank in litigation venued in the Eastern District, United States District Court, Eastern District for Michigan. In that litigation, the entity there, Midwest Guaranty Bank, had alleged against Guaranty Bank that its public announcement to enter the same geographic market violated a number of statutes and common law theories. In particular, that underlying litigation or complaint, as I'll call it, alleged that Guaranty Bank's entrance into that Michigan market violated Section 43 of the Lanham Act. It also violated common law theories of unfair competition, trademark infringement, and the Michigan Consumer Protection Act. Guaranty Bank tendered the claim seeking coverage of that suit to Great Northern some 6 months after that claim was filed on June 11th of 2003, and then on June 17th, some few business days thereafter, Great Northern denied coverage in that claim. After the matter was removed to the federal district court and the parties engaged in discovery, both parties moved for summary judgment in November of 2006, which ultimately concluded with Judge Randa's decision in August of 2007. What's critical about this appeal is that in reaching its conclusion denying Guaranty Bank's motion for summary judgment, Judge Randa read Wisconsin law and found that it was incumbent upon Guaranty Bank to indicate that Great Northern was not prejudiced by the late notice in providing notice of the Michigan lawsuit. However, what is clear is that the court unfortunately got it wrong. Under Wisconsin statutes as interpreted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the law in Wisconsin is that where a insured provides late notice, but that notice is provided within 1 year of the suit, it is the carrier's burden, in this case Great Northern's burden, to prove that prejudice ensued.
Is it your problem then that he applied the wrong burden of proof?
Yes, Your Honor, in part.
Because if the burden of proof were to be with the insurance company and the evidence, everything is that you said it was just 6 months, but in 6 months, the Michigan district judge had a very comprehensive, I didn't read it, but just about what they were referring to, a very comprehensive preliminary injunction opinion. What is one to do when you first get a case that has been resolved and then saying, will you come in and defend it? Why? I don't see where even a shifted burden, if the burden were still with the insurance company, where that wouldn't be just on its face prejudicial.
Getting to your question, Your Honor, assuming the burden was perhaps on Guaranty Bank, which it wasn't in this case, what the difficulty in the judge's decision is that that evidence wasn't presented at the summary judgment level. If the burden had been on Guaranty Bank, it would have been clear that we could have shown that the carrier would have done nothing different. And in such situations, the case law in Wisconsin, and in particular the Bradley Fireman's Fund case, states that where you can show that the carrier would do nothing different, there can be no prejudice, and therefore we then get to the coverage issue. The problem with the lower court decision, quite frankly, is that by focusing on the prejudice issue, we never got to the heart of the merits, which is, did the Midwest Guaranty Bank suit allege a cause of action which triggered a duty to defend under the policy in question? The district court simply relied on the prejudice issue, and in that regard, assuming that it was on whatever side it was on, both parties, quite frankly, didn't pay much attention to it.
So the case rises and falls on Fireman's Fund?
That can't be the only case, and it depends upon the topic in which we're talking about. If it concerns prejudice, Fireman's Fund provides some guidance about when prejudice exists
and
what it doesn't.
Very different fact situation, wasn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, how could it be applicable here?
Well, I think the standards are applicable, and I think what's important there is they found that even where notice were provided 2 weeks before a preliminary injunction, there wasn't prejudice. Prejudice by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the Girard case, authored by Judge Coffey, states it has to be a serious impairment. And although there was a preliminary injunction involved, part of the reason to give notice is to allow the carrier to have time to investigate, participate in the defense, try to settle the matter, defend it.
I have trouble seeing how Fireman's Fund is applicable in this case, very frankly. I mean, my colleague's point seems to me to be a very valid one. I mean, gee, ask somebody to come in and indemnify and defend, and you got a preliminary injunction judgment staring you in the face you didn't know about. That's really that's really asking an awful lot.
I would concur that it puts the carrier in a disadvantaged position, but I don't believe it rises to the level of prejudice. It is a preliminary injunction, and the fact remains that it still had to go to hearing, potentially. There were still methods to settle it. And more importantly, what's difficult, I think, Your Honor, in responding in this instance is because the burden was not upon us at the lower court level to prove they were not prejudiced. Had the burden been on us to do so, I think the record reflects, based on the timing of when notice was given and 3 days later that coverage was rejected, that they wouldn't do anything differently. And in such situations where an insured such as Guaranty Bank can demonstrate that the carrier would do nothing different, had notice been timely, there is no prejudice as a matter of law. And so, therefore, the difficulty I have here, Your Honor, is that the judge ruled on this area, put the burden upon us where we didn't establish it in the record.
Well, an awkward position, right? Because they don't want to say we would have done something, because then they would be admitting that they had a duty to defend, right? It's a very awkward situation for them.
Well, the letter came so quickly, the denial letter, Your Honor, that I don't think they ever said they wouldn't do anything. They simply said we don't believe there's coverage here. And that would be the heart of the matter which we brought the claim in the first instance to determine.
When you start explaining why you don't think it's covered, you quickly get into the duty to defend issue, right?
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. And I believe that under the duty to defend principles in Wisconsin, the underlying complaint arguably triggered coverage. It's a fairly low threshold under Wisconsin law to determine when a duty to defend is triggered under a complaint. Well aware of the four corners rule.
Why on earth did Guaranty Bank wait so long?
The record is not clear on that point, Your Honor.
What do you mean it's unclear? Is there anything in the record?
The record does not have anything in the record about why it waited so long. What is clear is that counsel was engaged, discovery began, and a preliminary hearing was held, at which time the ruling of which you speak was issued. Nonetheless, at that time, there was still not a serious impairment to the ability to defend the matter on the one hand. And again, it's difficult here because the evidence was not there. We were not asked at the lower court to show why they weren't prejudiced. But what is clear is that they're not alleging witnesses weren't there.
So you're asking them to jump in after a preliminary injunction has been issued?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that's a very very unfortunate situation to be in.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Lost the first round.
You're correct, Your Honor. But, again,
this doesn't make sense. You're not a little person. I mean, your Guaranty Bank is not some hapless individual who doesn't know what's going on. You've got a major company that drops the ball, and then after it's almost lost the case, then it asks the insurance company to come in. That's very make any sense.
On that point, Your Honor, again, the difficulty I'm having here is that the way the burden was established in the lower court, that evidence was presented. And at the same token, the evidence that was supposedly put forth by Great Northern is void. There's not one cite to any affidavit, to any discovery,
to
anything.
It stands to reason, right? You don't ask the lawyer to represent you for nothing after you've botched the initial stages of the case. Anyway, I don't understand how there's how they could have violated their duty to defend, because there's no registered trademark.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no registered trademark. However, I don't believe that the policy was clear in that regard.
The policy is clear. And wasn't it clear from the attachments to the complaint that there was no registered trademark?
It is correct that the civil cover sheet attached to the complaint that was filed in the Eastern District did say that it was not a registered trademark.
It's not a registered trademark. And isn't the exclusion, the IP exclusion, isn't it clear that if you don't have a registered mark, it's excluded? What's the ambiguity?
Well, I think the ambiguity arises under the advertising injury provision, Your Honor. I don't think we get to the...
I don't understand. You have an exclusion.
Well, I think we have to take it back a step if we can, Your Honor, which is this is a duty to defend case. So the first instance we're looking is whether or not the four corners of the complaint allege a claim that would be arguably covered under the policy. And as our assertion...
Yeah, but you have to compare the complaint to the policy.
That's correct,
Your Honor. The policy includes an exclusion. You have to look at the exclusion.
Right. I agree.
Where you see in the complaint there's no registered trademark, and the exclusion excludes unregistered trademarks. So that's the end.
But I think that the problem here, I think, Your Honor, is in the definition of the advertising injury and what registered means. At this point,
registered means it's on the trademark registry in Washington, right? What else could it mean?
Well, we're not sure. There's also, it could have been...
not sure. What are you talking about?
Some of the trademarks, for example, in this case, Your Honor, could have been registered under a Michigan system as well, too. It's not clear what registered mean. The Great Northern goes to great lengths in their brief to say it's under the Trademark Act, but nowhere in the policy does it state that. If they meant it to mean that, they should have written that. And the Wisconsin case law on that point is fairly clear, that if there's any confusion whatsoever... That confusion should be...
There's a Michigan trademark registry?
There is not a Michigan registry, Your Honor. They could have filed, and I apologize at the present time, the agency they could have filed with, but because it's a financial institution, I believe there was somewhere in Michigan they could have filed as well, which they did not as well, though, Your Honor. The evidence shows that neither Midwest Guarantee Bank nor Guarantee Bank filed with that agency as well.
Registered trademark is pretty familiar. I never heard of a non-federally registered trademark.
Well, again, Your Honor, it's not defined in the policy and pursuant to the Wisconsin law.
But you can't read a document without some background knowledge, right?
And I concur, Your Honor, but I think we do have to take a step back as well and take a look at the four corners of the complaint. And nowhere in the four corners did it state it was registered or not registered, despite the fact that the civil cover sheet did in fact say that, Your Honor.
That's part of the complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why isn't that put within the four corners?
Well, I don't think it is part of the four corners, Your Honor. I apologize.
I don't understand you.
Well, the civil cover sheet is a civil cover sheet.
Who filled it out?
I assume that counsel for Midwest Guarantee Bank. However, the civil cover sheet in and of itself is not the complaint. It's not the allegations from which coverage is determined. For example, civil cover sheets in all various jurisdictions are fairly, to a certain extent, Your Honor, pro forma, in that there are many boxes that can be checked or not checked to give the court the sense of what the claim is about.
Do you have the civil cover sheet?
I believe it is part of the...
Is it in your appendix?
Your Honor, I don't believe it's part of my appendix. I believe that it was cited to in the record by Great Northern. It is in the record, Your Honor. Yes, it is.
Another mystery. So critical to your argument is this notion of a public announcement. Where is the public announcement?
Well, there's no evidence of what exactly that meant, Your Honor. But again, going back to the rules that define...
Now I'm lost. You don't have the public announcement?
Well...
How do we know whether the public announcement was advertising?
Well, the issue, again, Your Honor, is there a duty to defend? And looking at the four corners of the complaint, we do that. And in paragraph 10 of the underlying complaint...
This is ridiculous. I mean, your conception of the duty to defend is so broad that they'd be defending the most utterly unrelated litigation. What if this public announcement was something filed with the SEC or something? So it's a public document.
Well, again,
that's not advertising.
Wisconsin law creates a very high burden for insurance carriers to defend.
Not this high. I don't understand why you couldn't produce the public announcement.
It was never sought in discovery, and the only issue in discovery, Your Honor, is the four corners of the complaint.
Look, I'd like to know what a public announcement is.
The problem, Your Honor, is that in Wisconsin, you're not to look at extrinsic evidence.
I believe it's as rigid as you say. It doesn't make any sense. I can't imagine a complaint you couldn't twist into something subject to the duty of defend just by playing with words. Saying, oh, public announcement, that must be advertising.
Well, based on the definition of advertising under the policy in Wisconsin case law, it can be any notice of goods and services, and therefore a public announcement would seem so.
What, if they send a letter to Afghanistan or something saying, oh, by the way, we're entering this new market, writes it to a friend in Afghanistan, that's a public announcement?
Well, I think in the context of this complaint, Your Honor, they're saying the public announcement was in the...
You're not answering my question. You think any announcement is a public announcement, unless maybe it's given under seal.
It's difficult to answer based on that, Your Honor.
Why? Why is it difficult to answer? I gave you a good case.
I think
it's a letter to his friend in Afghanistan saying we're going into this new market. Is that a public announcement?
It doesn't seem to be based on your scenario, Your Honor. It does not. I think, however, though, in the context of this complaint, where it talks about Guarantee moving into this market, making a public announcement of its goods and services being there, and looking at the definition of advertisement under the policy, and looking at the definition of advertisement under Wisconsin case law,
why
didn't
you ask them what the form of the public announcement is?
Why didn't we ask who, Your Honor?
Ask Chubb, or, you know.
Well,
Great Northern, they know they were sued.
But the issue, Chubb, they weren't sued. The advertising was...
I don't know, they weren't sued, I understand. They settled.
But we look at the four corners.
You were sued.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, you must know what the public announcement was.
Yeah, it's not... I'm...
I mean, you settled the case, right?
I'm reluctant, Your Honor, only
you
because it's not in the record.
Why isn't it in the record?
Because the only issue in the record, Your Honor, is a duty to defend claim. And the only issue you look at is
a... duty to defend depends on what Midwest was suing about.
No, the only thing you look at under Wisconsin law is the complaint. You don't look at extrinsic evidence. So you look at the complaint and see...
If you have to interpret the policy, public announcement is just extremely vague, and there isn't any... I don't know what the basis is for thinking that could be an advertising.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Cunningham?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Dan Cunningham, and I represent the insurance companies in this case. Your Honors have already raised a number of the issues that I had anticipated addressing this morning, so I will be brief. The Great Northern policy, of course, required that Guarantee Bank provide notice of lawsuits immediately. Guarantee Bank does not dispute that it failed to comply with this important precondition to coverage. Rather than dispute the timeliness of their notice, they address the prejudice issue, which, as we know, is read into insurance policies in Wisconsin by virtue of two statutes. We heard a lot already about the allocation of the burden of persuasion with regard to the prejudice issue. And we submit that the allocation of the burden is ultimately inconsequential in this case, because regardless of how the burden is allocated, we proved that we were prejudiced.
What was before the district court, Judge Randa? As I read it, there apparently were quite a few briefs filed in Michigan before the preliminary injunction. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that then he also had the judgment, which he referred to as fairly comprehensive.
That's correct.
So all of that was before the district court.
Indeed it was. In order to prove the prejudice that is inherent in this circumstance, we took the critical pleadings, the motions, the briefs, the orders, and submitted them to the judge and said, look at everything that happened in this case before they even bothered to give us notice. And, of course, we also gave the very comprehensive opinion in which the judge went through virtually every issue in the underlying case, ruling against Guaranty Bank. And it's our position that irrespective of who had what burden, this circumstance is inherently prejudicial. And for that reason, we contend that the court was correct to grant summary judgment in our favor.
Is there anything, because I have this is just a curiosity, is it possible, and I don't know what you know or whatever, when Guaranty Bank gets this lawsuit, I think the first thing they might look at is their insurance policy. And I am just curious, if they looked at that and said, we're going to have to do this ourselves because we don't have coverage. That's the only way I can rationalize how this went this way. And is there anything discussion of that, or was that ever argued, or somehow or other, why somebody didn't read the policy in the first place?
There's nothing in the record in that regard, Your Honor. Okay. It would not surprise me if, in fact, they completely ignored the insurance coverage issues, realizing that there was no registration here, and they therefore had no potential for coverage in the first place. And they simply proceeded on to defend unsuccessfully the underlying case. And then when they lost, they thought, maybe we can tender this to the insurance company and trap them in some kind of estoppel situation, which is an issue that you hear a lot about in the briefs filed in this case. They contend that we're estopped from raising any coverage defenses in this case because we didn't intervene in the underlying action or file a declaratory judgment action or move to bifurcate the underlying proceeding. We submit that we could not have done any of those things because they didn't give us notice until after they lost the case. Intervening at the point that we got notice would have been meaningless because the liability issues had already been resolved. There would have been no way that we could have had the court address coverage issues before the liability issues because the liability issues had already been covered. Now, of course, Guaranty Bank relies heavily on the Fireman's Fund versus Bradley case. I agree that that case is distinguishable because there the insurance company actually got notice before the preliminary injunction proceeding rather than after. As a result, the prejudice here is that much more appreciable. Clearly, the court correctly concluded that the late notice barred the duty to defend. But even if the court was wrong, and even if I'm wrong about the late notice issue, we still have all of the other coverage defenses that were discussed here today. There is no registration. They admitted here today that there is no state or federal registration. And they have admitted that the complaint doesn't allege a registration. As there is no registration, the definition of advertising injury is not satisfied, and there can be no coverage.
In plain terms, what do you view the coverage in the policy?
The policy affords coverage for infringement of registered trademarks arising out of advertisements and excludes all other trademark claims. So claims involving unregistered trademarks are not covered by virtue of the exclusion.
Registered trademark is the only coverage.
Correct.
But isn't that civil cover sheet critical because they might allege trademark infringement without bothering to mention registered?
It is a critical document. We did submit it to the court. It is part of the record. And I believe it's docket entry 32. It's attached to that affidavit. It is certainly a part of the record, and that clearly establishes that there is no registration here.
Is that sort of coverage common in the industry?
Many general liability policies afford some amount of intellectual property exclusion within the advertising injury definition. Mm-hmm. Our policies are rather narrow in that regard because they modify the word trademark with the word registered. Only registered trademarks are potentially covered. And again, that's different than the Fireman's Fund case because in Fireman's Fund, the policy applied to all trademark claims, irrespective of whether there was a registration.
I understand. But I wondered if you're, if you, the type of coverage you offered, your client offered in this case, is typical in the industry. I mean, do people seek out this sort of coverage usually?
Yes. I believe this type of coverage is typical. And I believe it is not at all uncommon to exclude for many other types of intellectual property claims, such as was done here. Again, even if we're wrong about that issue, there are other coverage defenses. Of course, there's a rule in Wisconsin against receiving pre-tender defense costs. Even if by some stretch we were deemed to have breached the duty to defend, we wouldn't owe for any defense costs incurred prior to tender, and it turns out that all but 18,000 of their defense costs were incurred prior to tender. I talked a little bit about estoppel. Estoppel cannot apply absent a breach of the duty to defend. There has been no such breach here. Estoppel also cannot apply because we were not given the opportunity to intervene in the underlying case before the liability issues were resolved.
I was just thinking about the question Judge Ripple raised. One thing that occurred to me is that you're less likely to be sued, I think, for violating a registered trademark because you would do a search of the registry, presumably, if you have your own advertising. You don't want to infringe, so you can check the trademark registry and avoid suit if you notice there's a registered mark. But if it's unregistered, then you know you get into all sorts of murky litigation over whether you had notice and whether it's really infringing and same market.
Exactly. And it's those types of cases that are so hard to underwrite for that they have to be excluded. If there are no other questions or comments, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cunningham. Mr. Johnson, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute if you have anything further you'd like to say.
One important thing to bring us back to, Your Honor, however, is just simply where this case stands procedurally. The difficulty the Guaranty Bank has at one level on this case is the basis upon which this decision was decided. And it was based on a decision that the district court believed that we had a burden to prove prejudice, and we didn't do so. It's very clear, I don't think that opposing counsel contests the issue, that under the statutes in Wisconsin that it was their burden to show prejudice. I think it's important on the summary judgment level, on that basic level, Your Honor, that there was no citation to the record other than the preliminary injunction being issued.
But their argument is that as a matter of common sense, if you don't ask your lawyer to, if you don't ask the insurance company to pick up the defense until you've lost a preliminary injunction hearing, preliminary injunction, it's prejudice per se. They're very much behind the eight ball.
And I appreciate the argument, Your Honor, but they don't cite to any case law.
What in the way of evidence could you add that would make that? Whatever evidence would you need?
On the issue solely of prejudice, Your Honor, is that
differently? Why isn't forgetting about what the initial burdens are? Once they have shown that the defense wasn't tendered until after a preliminary injunction had been issued, why isn't that enough evidence to shift the burden of production to you to show that there was no prejudice?
It's not enough because the statute doesn't call for that. As long as notice is given within a one-year period, it always rests with them. Having said,
look at the circumstances, and one of the circumstances is that the preliminary injunction had been issued. So that's their evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't that enough evidence to put a burden on you of producing some contrary evidence that they weren't prejudiced?
I see. To rebut that presumption of prejudice. Well, because the case law doesn't require it, number one, and number two, if there is still questions of fact in that point, and that's why I want to raise the issue that we're still at the summary judgment level, if that the judge found it on this basis, had the burden been on us or something more than necessary, it's important to note they did not pursue this in any great vigor at the district court, the issue concerning prejudice. They went right past it. What we would have been able to show, if we were allowed, if the burden was correct, is that they would not have done anything differently. Now, I appreciate the early argument that gets us from the frying pan into the fire as it relates to the coverage issues, but solely on the issue which the district court decided was incorrect because we didn't have the burden, and we could have probably demonstrated, or we hope to demonstrate, if the factual record is allowed to be shown, that they wouldn't have done anything differently. That wasn't shown because it was not our burden at the district court level, Your Honor. Thank you for the additional time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Penny.